This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the whole non-white world needs reparations. A human rights activist explains that Europe and America are only rich because they've made the rest of the planet's people poor or dead. And Bruce Dixon takes a look at President Obama's legacy as the greatest privatizer in the history of American public education. But first, the Belgians, who killed at least 12 million Congolese when they colonized that country, now play the role of global victim in the wake of an attack by the Islamic State. We spoke with Arun Kundnani, author of the book The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror. Kundnani is a British citizen of Indian extraction who lectures at New York University. He says Europe and the United States have earned their enemies.
You know, the way that we think about what's happened is that this kind of terrorism just comes out of the blue. And what we ignore is of course, that we are in a cycle of conflict. We inflict violence around the world, and other people inflict violence on us. It's not all one way. Last year, we dropped 22,110 bombs on Iraq and Syria. Not something that is reported very much, but that is what we did. Officially, according to the Pentagon, that resulted in only 6 civilian deaths. We know that, in fact, thousands of civilians would have been killed as a result of our bombing campaigns just in the last year. And so because we don't spend very much time thinking about that, when something like what happened in Brussels hits the news, we tend to then just think the only possible reason this can happen is that this is just what these people are like. This is just their culture. It's a problem with Islam. It's a problem with the culture of these people. So we fall back on these kind of cultural explanations in the absence of an understanding of the actual experience that we are subjecting these people to.
Yes, what you say is it's not their culture, it's our, and I guess you mean by that European and American politics that is at the root of these conflicts.
Absolutely. And I think just like anything else, there are nuances to this. It's complex. It is not a mechanical process whereby we bomb another part of the world and they retaliate in a kind of automatic way. There is still a responsibility morally on the people who are carrying out these attacks. Of course, moral responsibility lies with the perpetrators of anyone who wants to inflict violence on civilians, like what happened in Brussels. But by the same token, if we're going to be morally consistent about this, then we also have to condemn when our violence kills civilians, which it does with regularity. And so I think once we look at it in that perspective, we can understand that this is more about politics than it is about culture or religion.
And of course, the events in Brussels will increase calls among Europeans to keep refugees from other parts of the world from coming in. But isn't there something horribly perverse about a Europe which over the last half a millennium has touched and distorted and colonized almost every other corner of the world, affecting all the other world's peoples, a Europe that thinks that it can somehow wall those same people off of its soil?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm from the United Kingdom. We had a slogan there when we were dealing with issues of racism where we would say, we are here because you were there. The reason that I have Indian origins, the reason that my family were in Britain is because India was colonized by Britain. And then suddenly people in Britain would turn around and say, well, why did you even come to this country? Because they had erased that history that had shaped our very presence. they didn't have the historical memory of what their own country had done. So absolutely, and the same, of course, is true of Belgium, of France, of the Netherlands. They all had hundreds of years of colonial history. In the case of France and Netherlands, the history of the slave trade. And even in relatively recent history, I think that the context is important here. In Belgium, 10 years ago, the leading political organization amongst young people of color in Belgium was an organization called the Arab European League. Its politics were inspired by Malcolm X. And it was not a religious ideology that was driving it so much as a black nationalist ideology translated for the Belgian context. What happened to that organization? Well, it was suppressed, its leaders were prosecuted, and so the vacuum that resulted was then filled by groups with more of a kind of jihadist ideology, and the people who today are considered to be the perpetrators of what happened in Brussels on Tuesday have emerged from those jihadist networks. So yet again, you know, the attempt to suppress political opposition, to suppress community organizing, has ended up leading to more violence and more conflict rather than any kind of genuine peace.
And in terms of trying to project one's own crimes and one's own hostilities on the other, black Americans know a lot about that. We have someone running for president who used to refer to lots of young black people as predators. And we all know about the demonization of what lots of white people here call ghetto culture, as if it is black folks' presence that leads to crime, not the conditions of U.S. society.
Right. I think, you know, it's worth recognizing those parallels, absolutely, because in the same way that central part of the way that American racism discourse thinks about black people is this focus on culture, right? This kind of idea that somehow the status of black Americans is not because of structural racism, but because of a culture that holds people back. Those kind of themes obviously go back right to the 1960s with the Moynihan Report and things like that. Well, exactly the same kind of mobilization of culture is happening in relation to Muslims in the war on terror. So that instead of saying the reason that this conflict exists is because of structural issues, instead of saying that, we say that it must be something to do with their culture. And that way we can, just as we do with black people, we can then say the problem is not white America. The problem is not the non-Muslim America. The problem is an external problem. And white America can kind of create this idea of innocent and beneficent and blame these conflicts and antagonisms exclusively on the other. That's why I think it's important to understand Islamophobia as another form of racism, because it shares that structure with anti-black racism.
Here in the United States, some people are fond of saying that Muslims and other folks in the world hate us because of our freedoms. But I guess they won't have to hate us much longer since our freedoms are rapidly disappearing.
Right. Well, yes, exactly. And if it were true that it was some notion of freedom that was the source of it and generating some kind of hatred, that would be an interesting irony. Of course, the reality is that it's not who we are that is the problem, but what we do that is the problem. It's our foreign policy, not our cultural values. And so as long as we keep telling ourselves this story that somehow this is a clash of civilizations, we're going to basically continue this violence. All the opinion poll data that has been done all consistently says people in the Middle East do not have any antagonism to the United States itself or its values. What they have an antagonism to is U.S. foreign policy in the region, the support for authoritarian regimes like the Egyptian military, like the Saudi regime, and of course the Israeli occupation of Palestine. And all the opinion poll data shows that, in fact, if you ask people in the Middle East what percentage of people in the Middle East that would consider it acceptable to inflict violence on civilians, the number is actually lower than it is when you ask the same question in the United States or in Europe. So the idea that somehow there is something inherently fanatical and violent about Middle Eastern culture doesn't really stand up to the empirical research that's been done on that.
That was Arun Kundnani speaking from New York. Black Agenda Report editor and columnist Ajamu Baraka, a co-founder of the U.S. Human Rights Network, recently returned from Europe, where he attended the 15th anniversary of the United Nations World Conference Against Racial Discrimination, which was first held in Durban, South Africa in 2001. Baraka was also on hand for the UN's Day of Remembrance for the victims of slavery and the Atlantic slave trade.
The Day of Remembrance is an attempt by a group of African states at the UN working with a couple of NGOs to try to keep the attention on the fact of the slave trade and the consequence of the slave trade, which basically literally resulted in the creation of the power of Europe. This is one of the arguments that came out of the Durban process in which that analysis was advanced. And, of course, there was resistance to that because part of what was being raised was that if that is, in fact, the reality that the transatlantic slave trade and the genocide committed against Native people in various parts of the Americas served as the material base for the ascendancy of Europe, then justice demands that some type of repair, reparations, needed to be considered as part of a global justice project. So, of course, the European states rejected that. So one of the things that the African group then was able to put in place was to, on their own, to have this international day so we can keep that conversation going. Now, what we're trying to do is to connect that up with the ongoing conversations of the UN to put in place a permanent forum for African people to deal with not only the consequence of the slave trade, but the consequence and continued reality of colonialism, and to connect that also to the decade that the UN put in place to recognize the plight of the people of African descent over the next now 9 years. So we're trying to connect all of these things together as part of the political and sort of ideological conversations that are taking place at the UN and taking place within the context of various organizations that are involved in doing political work in various parts of the African world.
Well, Europe and the European world, including the United States, have a lot to answer for. It seems, and I'm not trying to be cynical here or belittle the commemoration, but it sounds like the commemoration of the International Day of Remembrance is like a consolation prize.
Well, it could be seen that way, and I don't know if people are looking at it as so much a prize, but as a weapon to continue the struggles that these groups are involved in at the UN level. And I think that some of the European states that show up to this international commemorance probably see it as something that they are doing to sort of compensate somewhat. But I think the states and the organizations that are involved in this process understand that this is just one little small piece, and they don't see this as any kind of real expression of justice and definitely no commitment to repair that the international community needs to engage in to address the consequences of the slave trade and the continued coloniality of power.
Now, this week, the Europeans are upset about what happened in Brussels and seem to be in a mood to characterize themselves as somehow the victims of history.
Exactly. I mean, the pathology of white supremacy is, again, on global expression. I mean, we've had these terrorist attacks take place in various parts of the world with numbers that exceeded the numbers that took place that we saw in Brussels. And, of course, for many of us who are human rights defenders and activists, all human life is important. All human life has intrinsic value. But this notion that the lives of Europeans carry more value, more weight, and should be seen as more significant than other lives, to me, is really obscene. I mean, we had an attack in Africa just a couple of weeks ago, I think around March 14th or so, in which more than 20 people were murdered at this resort. But we didn't see the kind of international outrage and solidarity that we have seen with the attack in Brussels. We have seen attacks in Turkey. We've seen attacks and still in Baghdad and other places. We've seen U.S. attacks, drone attacks taking place in various parts of the world in which there are innocents that end up being murdered by U.S. attacks. But there hasn't been the international outcry to stop those expressions of state terrorism. So it's really obscene what we're seeing. And I mean, the expression that the world is concerned and the world is outraged, I mean, the easy deconstruction of that is that when they refer to the world, the only world to them that has any real value are the G7 states, the European states. So this is really an obscene expression, but it's reflective of, you know, we're talking about the Durban process and the international decade of the people of African descent. It's reflected in the lack of commitment to even those consolation prizes, if you will. Within the UN structures, they have put really almost no money toward the international decade. They undermined the Durban review process. They really care nothing about non-European life. So, you know, we see, you know, what's happening with the decade, and we see these expressions of concern coming out of Brussels, and the pattern is quite obvious to most of us, that basically the only lives that matter are white lives.
Yes, we may see a decade of waiting for the European world to own up to what it owes the rest of the world.
Right, and that's where some of us sort of depart with others from the reparations process and demand. I think reparations is a legitimate demand to be made, but the notion that reparations is going to be achieved within the context of the current global relations of power, it's quite naive, and it's not a position that many of us hold. We understand that if there's going to be reparations, repair, that repair will only come when the relations of coloniality have been transformed. That is, that when the European project has been finally and completely dismantled, when power has been shifted from the hegemony of Europe to the rest of us, then we have the material conditions, the new relationships that will allow for real repair to take place. Beyond that, we don't see it, because basically anything less than the complete dismantlement of the colonial capitalist system is a reform movement that they will string us along with, but they will never really commit to.
And the headquarters of the capitalist system is the United States. To your knowledge, was there any commemoration, any day of remembrance of the slave trade at the White House this week?
No acknowledgement. And as you said in your question, in fact, the U.S. has led the effort to undermine the Durban process, the World Conference Against Race, and what came out of it, which we refer to as the Durban process. They have been the state that's given cover to the other white settler states and the other European states to undermine and to slander the process, even under our so-called black president. So no commemorations, not even rhetoric, nothing. All we've seen from the administration over the last week during this whole period of the Durban process and Durban 15 process is their statements related to their concern about what happened in Brussels.
And regarding what happened in Brussels, one writer has said that one could take the Europeans and their anguish over human suffering more seriously if the Eiffel Tower and the Empire State Building were lit up in the colors of countries like Somalia and Libya and Syria and Afghanistan, who have suffered so much at the hands of the European world.
Exactly. And we know that that will never happen because there is a dichotomy in terms of the value of life. And again, white lives matter, not non-European lives. Plus, to light up those monuments and the colors or the flags of those states that you reference would be to acknowledge the fact that the suffering in those states came about as a consequence of the direct action of the U.S. and European vassal states. Operating through NATO, that these states have been systematically destroyed as a consequence of the intervention, the criminal intervention by the European powers who are desperately attempting to try to maintain their global hegemony. So they're not going to acknowledge that, and they're not going to acknowledge the ongoing state terrorism that they are involved in globally.
In terms of Black America, how much attention, how much traction is there behind the organizing efforts around the Durban Review? An old head like me can remember when we had a very active African Liberation Support Committee in the 1970s and the Boycott South Africa movement in the 1980s. Is there any counterpart on the ground of that kind of significance today?
No, and part of the reason why there was no real traction coming out of the World Conference Against Race back in 2001 was because of the diversion of attention to the post-9/11 environment and the slander, the systematic slander of the process that was carried out by Israel and various Zionist forces to redefine the Durban process and the World Conference meeting as one that was anti-Semitic. And so the Negro leadership in the U.S., people like John Lewis, Alistair Hastie out of Florida, and a significant number of the Congressional Black Caucus members basically fell into line. And they also, if they didn't outrightly slander the process, they supported the notion that the process was not really important and it could be ignored. In fact, they gave, I think, Barack Obama some political cover when he was making his decision on whether or not the U.S. was going to attend the Durban Review process back in 2009. He said, basically, if you don't attend, we will probably make a few little comments about that, but don't worry, we're not going to really hold you accountable to that. And that's what, in fact, happened in 2009, that one of the first major decisions made by the Black president was to boycott the Durban Review process, the only U.N. process, the only U.N. conference that really was dealing with the issue of ongoing racial oppression, white supremacy, ongoing colonialism in the world. And the Black president led the assault on that process. So no, there's no institutional presence within the U.S. at this point, no strong one, that is, to support the different process. Part of what we are hoping to do with the decade is to bring attention back to the process and to begin to try to engage in some political education so people can understand what that document is, that is the Durban Declaration and Program of Action, that document represents some of the most progressive language and programs regarding racial discrimination, xenophobia that exists, and that it can be used as an instrument of public education and policy demands for African people really throughout the world, but primarily in the African diaspora.
And how much attention are the various elements of what's called the Black Lives Matter movement paying to this document?
Not much. I mean, they, like many people in the U.S., are not that aware of the document. So we can't really necessarily criticize that lack of knowledge. We hope to try to correct that, make many of these groups aware of the document so they can make a determination to what extent they could use some of the provisions in that document in their local and national organizing work. And so we want to try to take advantage of this decade to, in fact, engage in that kind of political education and organizing that the decade might provide for us.
And in terms of organized undermining of the Durban process, Hillary Clinton, whom almost all of the Black leadership supports, promises to be even more pro-Israel than Barack Obama.
Exactly, and the Clintons were the ones that helped to create the environment that ended up undermining the Durban process. They supported the representation of the World Conference as being anti-Semitic, and we don't expect that Hillary Clinton would be favorable or would support in any real way in terms of resources supporting the International Decade on People of African Descent. So no, we don't expect that the Congressional Black Caucus will get on board either. We're going to make the attempt to try to get them on board. But again, we don't expect much from them, and the real efforts will be made toward making people involved in grassroots organizing aware of this document to see if they can use it to the extent that they can or want to. We don't put too much emphasis on these UN structures and these processes. I mean, they can be important, but their importance is reflected in how they are used politically. We're not going to perpetuate the notion that the UN or any of its structures are going to be able to liberate African people. That liberation of African people and all oppressed people will have to come about as a consequence of their own actions and activities. So ideologically, politically, we can use these processes, we do, but we're not going to give the impression that these processes, they're still under the control of the colonial powers, are going to be able to liberate us. If that was the case, Palestine would already be liberated, and there would be no bombing in Yemen, and that there would be no drone attacks across the world, and Rumsfeld, George Bush, and Barack Obama would be in front of the International Criminal Court. If there's real justice in the world today and real international accountability to international structures and international law.
And so what's the next step in this Durban organizing process?
Political education around the existence of the decade and the Durban Declaration and Program of Action so that people can determine for themselves how they might want to use it. We're going to attempt to try to build a national network of groups here and tie this work to the broader work of developing a national plan of action for liberation in the U.S., and we'll see what comes out of it. But again, you know, we take a sober and a mature position to all of these processes, and we see what we can get from it. And if we can't get much from it, then basically we'll do something else. But we're going to see how people will respond to this process, this declaration and program of action, and the decade, and see if we can utilize the decade and the program of action to help us in our educational and organizing work.
Human rights activist Ajamu Baraka. The City Council of Newark, New Jersey, unanimously voted into law Mayor Ross Baraka's Civilian Police Review Board. The People's Organization for Progress, POP, is one of the community groups that will have a seat on the board. POP Chairman Larry Hamm was pleasantly surprised at the City Council's decision.
It was my belief that the reason the mayor tried to establish the Police Review Board through an executive order initially in the spring of last year was because he knew that an ordinance from the City Council would make it stronger and that it would live beyond him, but he went the route of the executive order. My guess is because he didn't have the votes on the City Council. So it's been a year later and much agitation and much effort on the part of the grassroots organizations that have been fighting for the Police Review Board, which includes the People's Organization for Progress, the ACLU, and many other organizations that make up what's called the NCAP, the Newark Community for Accountable Policing Coalition. But the point I'm trying to make is that when it came before the council last week, it passed unanimously, and I was quite surprised by that. I did figure, just being an old person who has worked in government to some degree, it went before the council because there were enough votes there. But I didn't think it would be unanimous, but it passed unanimously, and I think that credit should go to the mayor and to the council. It should go to both of them. But here's the catch-22, is that even though the Police Review Board has been established through executive order and has now been codified in law through a municipal ordinance for its creation, it's still, the implementation of it will still be stymied because the police unions have vowed to go to court to try to stop the establishment of the Police Review Board, particularly around the issue of subpoena power. This Police Review Board will have subpoena power. Now, in New Jersey, that power is conferred by the state government of New Jersey, by the state of New Jersey. So there was a real question as to whether or not a body established by a municipal government could, in fact, accrue to itself subpoena power. But the way the mayor went about doing this was kind of clever, because they already have within city government a post called an auditor general. And that auditor general has subpoena power. His job is to audit city government and to make sure that there's no corruption, that laws and regulations are being followed, et cetera, et cetera. That auditor general has subpoena power. So I guess the mayor, the way he went about this is that he made the auditor general a part of the Police Review Board. And so through the Auditor General, the Police Review Board will be able to subpoena when necessary.
Yes, what is the difference between a review board that has subpoena power and one that does not, in a practical sense?
Well, in a very practical sense, the one that does not have subpoena power is really an advisory committee. It does not have the power to demand the appearance of police and police officials. It does not have the power to subpoena documents. And if you can't subpoena documents and bring forward witnesses and people that were involved in what may be a police brutality case, you really don't have much to go on. So having subpoena power certainly makes it more than an advisory committee. But I also must say that subpoena power in and of itself is really not enough. And this is something that all the review boards around the country have to contend with, and that is you must also have the power to punish. And that's the way you really drive behavior to, in fact, penalize those officers that are found to engage in police brutality. Now, what this review board does have is a joint power to work with the police director to develop a matrix for what the penalties will be in police brutality cases. Sort of, if anybody's been to federal court, you know that federal judges have guidelines within which they must sentence people. And so this matrix is kind of like a local government version of that. And the review board and the police director confer together, develop the matrix on what the penalties will be and punishments will be, and then they move to process these cases accordingly. So that gives this concept of the review board some more teeth in it. But like I said, it's still going to be a struggle. I mean, the question is still up in the air as to whether or not the review board, even though it's been established by executive order and now established by municipal ordinance, whether or not it will come into being. My feeling is that the unions will probably go into court, seek an injunction to stop any further movement around the review board until case is resolved. And who knows how long that could take, because, you know, I'm sure the police unions, say, for instance, at the local court level, say, for instance, that they don't get a verdict that is agreeable to them, they'll just appeal it up to the next level. Who knows? They may appeal this all the way up to the Supreme Court. I mean, we don't know. But we know that the police unions certainly have the resources to engage in a long and protracted legal struggle like that. But the greatest guarantor for the establishment of the police review board is the organized and mobilized community, a community that's organized and mobilizing against police brutality. You know, if people don't stay in the streets, this thing will never come into existence. We have to stay in the streets and keep the pressure on. And even once the police review board is established, we still got to be in the street and keep the pressure on, because look, the city of New York has had a police review board for half a century. A review board, by the way, that does have subpoena power. And look how many cases of police brutality there are in New York City every year, with a fully staffed, practically an agency of municipal government, is the police review board in New York City. And they still have these shootings and abuse of authority by police. So the best antidote to police brutality is the mass of the people organizing, mobilizing on a consistent and protracted basis against police brutality.
And let's make it clear, no review board can say that a police officer should go to jail for 5 years or 10 years for manslaughter or for life,
right,
or for murder. That's the judicial system that deals with that.
That's right. It has to go to the judicial system. And just this day, we have around the Akai Gurley case, decisions that show you just how unjust the criminal justice system is. Now, it was interesting. Officer Liang, who shot Akai Gurley, was indicted and did go to trial, which is rare, hardly ever happened, was found guilty. But the prosecutor said that he was not seeking jail time for Mr. Liang, that the loss of his job and everything else that he'll have to deal with as a result of that is enough punishment. So Officer Liang killed the Kai Gurley and will not go to prison, even though he was found guilty.
And, of course, the prosecutor is a creature of that local government.
That's Newark, right.
That would be a creature of the Newark or Essex County local government.
Right. In New Jersey, we have county prosecutors, which are accountable to the state attorney general. So that's all part of the state criminal justice system. Like if a police officer kills someone, you have to go through that system to get a murder conviction. If you go through that system and you don't get a conviction, then people appeal to the federal government and appeal to the U.S. attorney, who is federally appointed by the United States federal system. But it's a mixed bag even at the federal level. I mean, we have a handful of cases where people did go to the federal court system, the U.S. attorney, and there have been a few cases like that of Anthony Baez, like that in New York City, in North Faison, in New Jersey, where the feds were called upon to get involved. They got involved. They did investigations. They found grounds to indict. They indicted, and they took the police to trial. And in the case of Baez, the officer was convicted. I think his name was Labote in the Anthony Baez case. And in the Earl Faison case, five officers were convicted, but they were convicted like Labote on civil rights charges, because if you get a conviction in the federal system, you can't do murder because that's state statute. You have to do civil rights violation. And so even though, like here in New Jersey, they killed Earl Faison, and even though they went to jail, nobody went to jail for murder. They went to jail for civil rights violations, which had to do with them torturing Faison to death. And they went to jail for conspiracy because they tried to cover up their evil deed.
And that's like the Ku Klux Klan prosecutions in Mississippi two generations ago.
That's exactly right. You know, and we find ourselves going through this with each generation. And, you know, again, referring back to Kai Gurley, the family appealed to the federal prosecutor to get involved. And the federal prosecutor made an announcement, said there was no grounds for him to get involved. So eventually the effort to redress the death of Kai Gurley through the federal courts was closed to them by the same U.S. prosecutor that they appealed to investigate the case.
You and the People's Organization for Progress are agitating for federal intervention in a number of cases in northern New Jersey.
That's exactly right. In fact, we have for 2 months now been engaged in something we call Justice Monday. And every Monday we go, for the past 8 weeks, every Monday we go to the federal building in North where the U.S. Attorney for New Jersey's office is located. And we demonstrate outside the federal building every Monday from 4:30 to 6:30. And we're calling for federal investigations into the death of Abdul Kamal, who was killed by Irvington police in New Jersey, Jerome Reed, who was killed by Bridgeton police in New Jersey, Kashad Ashford, who was killed by Lyndhurst police in New Jersey, and Radaz Hearns, 14-year-old boy shot in the back four times by police in Trenton. And so we're also appealing. Now, Radaz Hearns survived, and we're also appealing for the U.S. attorney to bring civil rights charges in those cases, because in all four of those cases, the county grand juries, or you could call them the state grand juries, failed to indict anyone. As a result of the pressure that we've been putting on this entire past year, the U.S. attorney did announce that they were now investigating the case of Jerome Reed, who many know because you've seen the video of him. You've seen the video of Jerome Reed getting out of the police car with his hands raised. He had no weapon. He shot to death at point blank range by a black officer, Brahim Dave. So we got to keep the pressure on. We're hoping that the U.S. attorney will not just stop with the Bridgeton case, but will go on and investigate and bring charges in this Irvington case, Abdul Kamal, and bring charges in the Kashan Ashford case and charges in the Radaz Hearns case.
The unanimous vote by the Newark City Council in favor of the Civilian Complaint Review Board shows that the police unions don't have all that much political pull in Newark, but that's not the case in terms of the New Jersey State Legislature.
That is exactly right, because if they had the power to block the council vote, they would have. And I've seen them exercise that power before. There was a case in Newark, New Jersey, that of Strawberry Daniels, who was shot to death in a police car in Newark, New Jersey, right on Clinton Chadwick Avenue. Now, this was some years ago. This had to be almost 20 years ago. The mayor of Newark at that time was Shark James, and as a result of the uprising in the community and massive marches out of the South Ward that were led by then activist Ross Baraka, the mayor of Newark began to make an effort. And I know because I was there and I was involved, you know, he was trying to put forward an effort to create a police review board. However, again, the police unions were outraged. They had, believe it or not, the police had a demonstration in front of Newark City Hall. And after that, not only did they scuttle the idea of the police review board, the proposal, they also caused one of the city council who was for the police review board not to be reelected. She lost her seat that year, but has subsequently regained it, and she is now the president of the Newark City Council. So the police are not just a paramilitary force, they're also a political force. They can financially contribute to campaigns, they can produce volunteers for campaigns, they can either act in the positive and provide resources and manpower to politicians that do their bidding, or they can mobilize their resources and manpower against politicians that do their bidding.
And they hold great sway in the New Jersey State House. What has Governor Chris Christie's stance been regarding this Newark Police Review Board?
I haven't heard recently, you know, I haven't heard Governor Christie say anything, but I tell you, I would really be surprised if he was not opposed to it. I think that he will end up getting involved in a negative way to try to block it. But now, for now, anyway, the fight is in the courtroom. And once we find out if there's going to be ongoing court proceedings, once we find that out, we'll mobilize people to be in the courtroom for those proceedings.
Now, basically, POP is in a partnership, an alliance with the mayor over the establishment of this Civilian Complaint Review Board. But you're an adversarial organization that agitates often against the city. How's it feel being a partner in this important project with someone that you've got to be on the other side of the fence with, or anticipate being on the other side of the fence with in the future?
It's not an easy road to hoe, so to speak. You know, we're trying to work with the mayor. We believe that Ross Baraka is progressive. He has a long history as an activist, and he has a long history as a progressive elected official. Even before he was mayor, he was councilman before he was mayor. And I believe he's trying to do the best he can. And he also has a great legacy to uphold, being the son of the writer and activist now departed Amiri Baraka. So we're trying to work with him. We're trying to support him when we can. But at the same time, you know, when issues arise that we feel we need to take a stand on, we're going to do so. You know, there was a police brutality incident last month where the Newark police stopped a young African-American teenager, and the result of the encounter was the police stopped this individual. They roughed him up and broke his shoulder and then left him laying in the road, wouldn't even call for any medical assistance. Let me tell you something. The officer that was involved in that was suspended the next day. I mean, it was in the newspaper the next day that he had been suspended. And he's probably going through, you know, whatever channels people go through when they have lost their job right now. But action was taken by the city. I think that the mayor is trying to do the right thing, but like with the water now we have a situation where a number of schools are going to be closed because the water pipes in those schools are lead tainted or lead pipes, and they've tainted the water. Now some 30 schools in Newark had lead levels in the water that were as high or higher than the lead levels in the water of Flint, Michigan. So in this situation, water is a human right, and we've already had one demonstration where we demonstrated not only for Flint, the brothers and sisters in Flint who essentially have been poisoned by the state, you know, and I don't say that figuratively, I say literally, that the state-appointed manager over Flint, Michigan, made a decision for cost-benefit result. He switched the water supply system from good water coming out of the reservoir where Detroit got its water to the highly polluted Flint River, which was polluted by the same auto industries that laid off workers and then ran abroad so that they could pay slave wages in Asia and Africa and Latin America. So now we have 11 cities in New Jersey, including Newark, that have lead levels as high or higher than that of Flint, Michigan. So we've already had one demonstration around that, and we're probably going to have others. So while, you know, we try to support the mayor where we can, we're still organizing and mobilizing in the street around issues that affect our community.
Larry Hamm of the People's Organization for Progress. President Obama's team is busy polishing up his legacy, which means there will be lots of whitewashing of the first black president's 8-year record in office. Black Agenda Report managing editor Bruce Dixon says Obama should be remembered for the huge damage he's done to public education.
President Barack Obama passed up multiple once-in-a-lifetime opportunities that might have made him the most popular president since Franklin Roosevelt. Obama refused to lock up any of the Wall Street crooks that caused the crash of 2007. He made investors whole, but not homeowners. He legalized and absolved Bush-era torturers, and he used the auto industry bankruptcy to slash wages, eliminate pensions, and offload retiree medical care onto workers' unions instead of their bosses. Obama even let automakers go back to making the same deadly, defective, climate-destroying products as before, when he could have redirected the industry's vast army of scientists and engineers to develop new products and processes to help us transition to a post-fossil fuel economy. But the Obama presidency has not been all about missed opportunities. Barack Obama did seize the chance at $4 billion in one-time stimulus funds he could distribute to states and school districts with no congressional or judicial oversight to further the bipartisan elite goal of wrecking and privatizing public education. Obama allowed consultants from the Gates, Broad, Walton family, and other pro-privatization outfits to draw up the award guidelines for what the president called his race to the top. It was really a race to hand over tens of billions in public assets to a galaxy of shady charter school operators and contractors, a race to normalize Common Core and other profitable test-and-punish regimes which provide the excuse to fire hundreds of thousands of teachers. It was a race to compromise the educational futures of millions of children. The Obama administration inflicted incalculable and lasting damage upon public education in the U.S. and helped seed the administrations of school districts, states, and the federal government with thousands of pro-privatization stooges from Teach for America, the corporate foundations, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and similar places. The good news in the final year of the Obama administration is that with all the stimulus money gone, the Federal Department of Education has far fewer means to force privatization and Common Core on states and school districts. The new Elementary and Secondary Education Act reserves states and school districts the autonomy to reject some federal initiatives, while Race to the Top and Common Core have spawned grassroots opposition among working-class whites around the country, including many nominal Republicans. The bad news, though, is that enormous damage has been done. The same charter school sugar daddies and privatizers who purchased the allegiance of Obama and elected Democrats also own Republican governors and state legislators, too. And that's where the fight is now. As the sun sets on the Obama era, the battles against school privatization, against charter school corruption, against test and punish and run the school like a business schemes are shifting to the states, to state governors and legislators, to local school boards, and crucially, to the national movement of parents and educators encouraging parents and students to opt out of the standardized testing regimes which have always provided the excuse to classify schools targeted for privatization and replacement. There's a video of a little black girl weeping because President Obama will soon have to leave office. If she and her parents knew what the first black president had done to public education, she wouldn't be crying. It's time for the organizers of the opt-out movement to double down on getting the case for opting out of standardized testing before black parents across the land who are perfectly capable of choosing between allegiance to their nominal leaders and allegiance to their own children and the futures of their families. You can find the National Opt-Out Movement online at www.unitedoptout.com. That's unitedoptout.com. And they should be able to hook you up with concerned parents and teachers near you.
President Obama knew it was impolitic to play his hypocritical human rights game while in the presence of Cuban President Raul Castro in Havana this week. So Obama had one of his kiss-up White House reporters do the sneak attack for him. CNN's Jim Acosta, the son of a Cuban exile, asked President Castro why his country kept political prisoners. Castro replied, "What political prisoners?" and asked Acosta to provide a list of such people. It was an awkward moment, not diplomatic at all, but Obama was clearly enjoying it. And well he might, because neither Jim Acosta nor any of the other corporate mouthpieces in the White House press corps would dare or even think to ask a U.S. president about the plight of American political prisoners. The U.S. media traveling with Obama have easy access to all sorts of lists of Cubans who are supposedly in prison for opposition to their government, although even Amnesty International says that the Cubans released their last political prisoner back in September. The United States, on the other hand, is still holding scores of political prisoners, many of them captured in the 1960s and 70s. Their numbers are decreasing only because they are dying of old age, accelerated by the inhuman conditions and practices of the world's largest prison system. If the corporate media were really concerned about political prisoners, they could go to the website of the Jericho Movement and see the pictures of 50 of them. 18 were members of the Black Panther Party, the Black Liberation Army, or the Republic of New Africa, including Mumia Abu-Jamal, whose life hangs by a thread because the state of Pennsylvania refuses to treat his hepatitis C. Black Panther Romaine Chip Fitzgerald has been incarcerated since 1969. There are men and women from the MOVE organization, all with the last name Africa, whose children were killed and their home bombed by the Philadelphia police. There are Native American activists from the First Nation group and American Indian Movement, including Leonard Peltier, who's been behind bars since 1976. There are white, class war, anti-imperialist, and anarchist hacker political prisoners, and Marie Mason, a white Earth Liberation Front woman, and black female community activist Reverend Joy Powell. There are prisoners who became political after they were imprisoned, which is why they're still there. There are Chicano political prisoners and the great Puerto Rican independence fighter Oscar Lopez Rivera. There is the former H. Rapp Brown, who's doing life without parole as Imam Jamil al-Amin. There are members of the Portland Seven and the Virgin Island Five and the Ohio Seven. There is the brilliant Mutulu Shakur, father of Tupac Shakur, who the feds say masterminded the escape and exile to Cuba of Asada Shakur. If Obama could somehow get her back behind bars in the U.S., he'd claim that she wasn't a political prisoner either. The Jericho Movement's pictures do not include lots of other political prisoners, like Reverend Edward Pinckney, who's serving up to 10 years in prison for nonviolently standing up for the people of Benton Harbor, Michigan. President Obama this week told the Cuban people, "I have come here to bury the last remnant of the Cold War." But he won't end the long war against black people in the United States, a war that has sent millions to prison under a political policy of mass black incarceration. And in that sense, they are all political prisoners.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.